Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's January 15th. Currently 14 degrees here in Old Town Park City under partly cloudy skies. And Heber City reporting 10 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Wasatch Beck. Yeah, good morning, Leslie. We've got another repeat of what we saw yesterday as far as partly cloudy, mostly sunny skies. Temperatures a little warmer today. High pressure is building in, so it's bringing in warmer air at some of the higher elevations. Mid-30s expected for daytime highs in Park City, 37 in Heber. As we get into tomorrow, the warm-up continues. Should see overnight lows near 19, 41 for the high on Thursday. We drop Friday to 35, and then we drop even further Saturday behind a cold front. So pretty calm the next few days, at least through Friday. Late in the day, we should see clouds increase on Friday afternoon, evening ahead of that front. We have some light snow showers, in fact, very light indeed into Saturday. I'd be surprised if we see a half inch to an inch of snowfall, even in areas like Park City. But 13 will be the temperature Saturday morning with 22 for that high. 23 on Sunday, we drop even further. Colder air moves in on Monday. Should see overnight lows near 0 degree, in the 0 degree range on Monday morning. Just 19 for the high Monday afternoon. Should be sub-zero temperatures, -2. Into Tuesday and 25 for the high, so some warming through midweek, at least next week, partly cloudy skies. Heber looking at a similar warm-up through tomorrow, low 40s expected on Thursday, upper 30s on Friday. We drop into the upper 20s on Saturday. Chance of a few snow showers on Saturday as well. Partly cloudy skies Sunday, just 6 degrees for the overnight low into Sunday, 28 for the high. Should be right around zero as well on Monday morning, 23 for our high in the afternoon, and then -5 possibly into Tuesday morning with 28 for the high on Tuesday afternoon as well.
Okay, Nate, thank you.
You bet.
And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, we've got Paige. Good morning, Paige.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great, thank you.
All right. Today we have a moderate avalanche danger. It's still possible to trigger a persistent slab avalanche in thin rocky zones or on slopes that may be already avalanched this season. We also have some warming today. Nate mentioned warmer temperatures, so we expect solar slopes to shed loose wet snow in the afternoon. We've had some recent avalanches reported to us, including loose wet, persistent weak layer, and two very interesting glide avalanches in Upper Broad's Fork. You can take a look on our website to see pictures of those.
What's a glide avalanche?
A glide avalanche is actually a very interesting avalanche where it usually doesn't fracture instantaneously. It moves over, slowly moves downhill over a period of time until it reaches a point where it can't sustain itself anymore. It usually happens on smooth rock surfaces, and we find those in the upper reaches of the Wasatch Range.
Okay. I'd never heard that term.
Not normal for this time of year. It's usually a springtime hazard, but this year is so far unlike any other. But our main concern is still the persistent weak layer, mostly on the north half of the compass in upper and mid-elevation terrain where we've still got the poor snowpack structure. We're sort of avoiding those steep slopes for a little while, yet they are gaining stability or gaining strength, but that doesn't mean that all slopes are stable. You might find a lingering wind slab here and there up in the highest, most exposed terrain. And also, like I said, due to daytime warming today, we expect wet avalanches to occur and maybe create large debris piles at the bottom of slopes.
Okay. Paige, thank you.
Hey, have a great day. Thanks.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with State Representative Mike Kohler. We'll get a preview of the upcoming legislative session that starts on Tuesday. Park City Manager Matt Dias in to preview this week's City Council meeting and an update from the Heber Valley Chamber with Executive Director Dallin Kosher. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include Ron Jackenthal, founder of Live Like Sam, taking a look at how the organization has evolved over nearly a decade now in existence. And nutrition writer Raina Goebel talks about how the FDA is changing which foods can be called healthy after 30 years of flawed dietary recommendations. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, of course, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Taking a look now at some local news, the Summit County Attorney's Office says a petition for a countywide vote on the controversial Kimball Junction development, Dakota Pacific can proceed. But first, KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that organizers will need to gather thousands of signatures.
Deputy County Attorney Helen Strawn delivered the news in a letter to referendum sponsors Monday after reviewing state land use law. In December, the Summit County Council voted 4-1 to allow Dakota Pacific Real Estate to build more than 800 units of housing and collaborate with the county on an expanded transit center, park and ride lot, civic plaza, and pedestrian bridge in western Kimball Junction. State law governing the referendum process indicates Councilmember Roger Armstrong's dissenting vote is what allowed seven residents to petition for a countywide vote on the controversial development.
I am positive that there will be a legislative fix to this, and I don't know what that would look like.
Armstrong said before the December 18th council vote.
I don't like bullies, and I think every now and then you have to hit a bully in the face. Now, he may kick your butt and still take your lunch money, but maybe you walk away feeling better about yourself.
The top concern expressed by residents at public hearings was traffic. They say gridlock should be addressed before building any additional housing in Kimball Junction, not during or after construction. Now, Summit County Manager Shane Scott says the sponsors will need to gather nearly 5,000 signatures to put the development on the next general election ballot.
They have to get 16% of the registered voters to sign the petition to refer the item.
That's also 16% from different regions of the county. The county is broken into four voting regions, and Utah law says signatures must count for 16% of voters in three of the four. The four voter regions don't coincide exactly with Park City, the Snyderville Basin, North and South Summit. All contain parts of the basin. Even if the referendum does not succeed, it affects the construction schedule because the vote would happen at the earliest in November of 2026. The next step required by state law is for the county's financial department to report what the referendum may cost the county and taxpayers. Scott says the report will include some of the community benefits Dakota Pacific promised Summit County would pay for. Some $4 million, he claims, will be lost if the referendum succeeds. The developer has also said its project would move Kimball Junction gridlock to the top of the Utah Department of Transportation's priorities.
How do we quantify a fix to 224 not happening? How do we do that? Now, I can't say that's not going to happen because the referendum passes, but it's in jeopardy, and that's something we're very concerned about from a staff level.
It's not clear how the state may react to the referendum legislatively. The Utah legislature previously passed laws to hurry along the Kimball Junction development in 2022 and 23. Summit County staff say there are as many as 30 land use and development bills in the works for the 2025 general session, which begins January 21st. According to Scott, the bills would shift land use authority up to the state away from counties and cities. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Utah State Legislature opens for its annual 45-day session on Tuesday, January 21st. On the phone with a preview, I have State Representative Mike Kohler, who represents District 59, which includes Park City and Wasatch County residents. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thank you. So let's start with the budget. Things, I guess, a bit tighter than what we have seen in the last few years. So what does that mean? Should the legislature have maybe thought twice before cutting income taxes and approving a child tax credit last year?
Right now, Mike, I'm not on any of the appropriations committees that are on that high enough level to know exactly what they plan. But in our discussions with the whole caucus talking about our plans, no, our income tax cut is still in the mix. We have a lot of things yet to adjust. I would say it's going to be a really tight year as far as the budget's concerned. Certainly most of the COVID or all of the COVID money that we've been able to spend in the last several years is gone. And so they're telling us that appropriations, individual appropriation requests are probably going to be difficult to get through. And on the first day, which obviously is coming quick, we will, those of us that aren't already in the circle, will get to know the details and what the budget will be, and at least the proposed budget, and get to start working on it. So I expect a really tight budget. I do expect to still have a tax cut offered. Might just mention that we didn't have a really large tax cut last year, income tax, but it was a cut, and we expect to have another one this year with the goal of a little bit each year, dropping a little bit each year, so that over time we have a result of lower taxes to our citizens.
What about relief for seniors? Because there's been talk about cutting their taxes on Social Security. Will that happen this year?
It's definitely in the proposed list, and so yes, I expect it to be, I'm not sure how much of it, but I expect a cut on that for sure. And I also expect several bills dealing with property taxes, which are severe for all of us because everybody pays a little bit more all the time depending on your time of evaluation of your house, and we've had a problem with that over the last couple of years, trying to strengthen that so that our property tax evaluations are better, more equal when the law says they're supposed to be, and also, though, focusing a little bit on senior citizens who are on fixed income and trying to make their life a little easier.
Well, and income taxes may have gone down, but prices are going up, and honestly, most of us haven't felt any relief, especially, as you mentioned, with the increase in property taxes that we have seen over the last several years. So where's the relief, I guess?
I would agree with that, because I had calls from citizens last year when our slight tax decrease on income tax came through, and they said, well, it's only saving me something like, you know, $50 or whatever. I mean, it's you can quantify it that way, but it's still a cut. And over time, as I said earlier, our purpose and our goal is to cut income tax over time. Individual cuts per year probably won't be that large. Certainly, inflation takes a gouge the other way continually. It's coming down a little bit, but until the federal government stops their extravagant spending, it's still going to continue. I expect when everything gets going in Washington, D.C., and some of the tax cuts and some of the financial decisions they make next year will probably have an effect on this, but it's going to take time to get rid of inflation in our lives. And certainly smaller than it's been, but it's still a burden.
Yeah. And as we know, I mean, income, why lower the income tax? Because the income tax is by the people who actually are most able to pay taxes, because what the statistics show, about half of Americans don't even pay income tax, just because they don't make enough money to pay income tax. So are we targeting the wrong tax here?
That discussion comes up all the time. It's still a tax, and it's still, yes, you're right, probably even a majority don't pay income tax, but it's still a tax in the state that we can control. Many states that are very successful in their budgetary processes don't have any income tax, and so it's something that's looked at that we do control. I think we're going to look at, as I mentioned, the property tax as well, because that's burdensome to everybody. So it's going to be a package. But I know the goal is to be, and I don't know if that's a laudable goal or not. I think it is to be like other successful states and lower tax burden across the board, and income tax is one of them.
Yeah. So what we're hearing, I think, is this reallocation of the budget. And if we're not talking about budget cuts, where are these reallocations going to happen?
I'm going to wait till I see all of them. I've heard rumors, and then we've had some discussions in the caucus about priorities, but I'm going to wait. I don't know in detail enough probably to discuss it until I see the first day where the tax is actually, or what the proposals are actually going to be. Our focus is still going to be on education. It's still going to, we're putting a little bit of a little bit of pressure on higher ed with some budgetary alternatives there for them to get a little bit more in line with producing and providing educational programs that succeed, where if you get the degree in that program, you have a better chance to make a living and pay your loans back or whatever might be success to you. We're also emphasizing technical education. I think there's going to be some reprioritization there. But as far as your question for the overall budget, I can't say that I'm acquainted with it enough to know exactly where those cuts and reallocations will be. I'm going to have to see the whole list next week.
All right. Another policy priority is housing affordability. I've heard we've got a couple dozen bills on housing affordability already filed. One we heard about requiring a minimum number of affordable units in all residential zones. So the legislature says it believes in local control until it wants to control local government. And I guess, how do you feel about this? I mean, why can't communities plan their communities without lawmakers telling us how to plan our communities?
Good question. And if you followed me at all, obviously I've been an advocate for local control, having been in local government for years in Wasatch County. It's an issue that we deal with every year. Of housing affordability, however, I would say, is seen by many legislators as a problem in some areas in Wasatch County, and Summit County actually get used as poster children for that, where we have a high demand, we certainly have high costs. And the idea in many legislators' mind is if we build more, they'll come down. I don't believe that, especially in Wasatch and Summit County. You could double them, in my opinion, and we still have a long list of people that want to live here, and the prices are high. Statewide, I've yet to see that that's made a big difference. But that said, towards that goal, and with you've got to include lobbyist push through home building side of the industry and of our economy, we're going to see, continue to see. I mean, I've heard 25 to 30 bills, but in the last several years we've been approached by or had many bills similar to it where the state figures that they lower local regulation by mandate from the state and take away some of the options of zoning and zoning regulation, that they can improve the velocity of growth. We'll see. I oppose all of them. I think local control is where it has to be and where it should be. Certainly our local citizens elect people that support the type of government that they want, and zoning and the lifestyle is part of it. And I resist those. I expect to see more of them, and I expect to see enough support to get many of them passed. We'll just have to see. And over time, I guess we'll see if it actually makes a difference in affordability or if it just changes our lifestyle, which I'm afraid it will.
Well, and something on our doorstep, of course, is the approval of the Dakota Pacific Real Estate Plan for Kimball Junction. As we know, hundreds of affordable housing units are proposed in that. But now we've got a referendum possibly on that. But for the Dakota Pacific proposal to work, Summit County needs a promise from the state legislature that UDOT will fix 224. Any idea whether 224 will be put on top of UDOT's STIP list this session? That's the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program I'm talking about.
Yes, I think it will. And let me say that been involved in this, at least a couple of years, watching it go. We were instrumental in getting the legislature to back off from one of these local control bills last year and letting Dakota Pacific and the county have another year to go through the process. That said, what's passed still has some problems as far as the locals are concerned. I know there is a referendum or at least filed, and we'll see if they get the signatures to put it on the ballot. And it'll go through. We'll see what happens, and we'll follow the process. That said, when it comes direct to UDOT, yes, I think they're going to be part of it. As I understand the plan that I've seen and parts that I've read, UDOT's progress on an improvement through that juncture of 224 is going to be has to be timed, and the building of these units have to be timed with some progress on that. So UDOT's been brought, and they've been in the process along, but they'll be brought on board to make sure that progress happens, to try and alleviate some of the congestion that's going to happen. And it's bad already, and we need the improvements to make sure that doesn't get worse. However, the big thing hangover right now is the referendum, and we'll see where that goes and how it's handled. But I think UDOT's going to be involved either way, whether it passes or not passes, in trying to get that improved as we approach another Olympics, just to help the problem during that. At the last Olympics, most people that lived around here at the time remember that UDOT and the transportation system improvements played a big role, and I think it will this time too, irrespective of whether Dakota Pacific proceeds or not.
Yeah, it worked best the Olympics because we kept cars out of the area, but with those large parking lots. But moving on, we have heard that Utah will have energy needs four times more than the energy that it can currently produce. So how is this problem fixed if Utah hopes to maintain its growing economy?
Energy is going to be a big emphasis. emphasis of this session. Electrical power is a big one. Obviously, we're losing coal-fired plants around the region. The state's got one. The IPP plant down has been in the past scheduled to be changed out, and Utah is taking a role to try and keep the old plant available, as well as making other possibilities available so that our electrical needs do not get overrun by the demand. It's been mentioned, and if you listen around to what's going on, these centers that are being built, information centers, are terrific users of power, even up to where they'll need the power, they'll demand power needs, which is almost as large as part of the city. So Utah has taken the approach where we're going for all energy. I think having the change in regime, if you will, or whatever, the president in federally is going to help with both oil and gas production and especially gas in helping keep the cost down to our citizens and also for energy production. But we're approaching this all the way around, whether it's geothermal, nuclear, or whatever, to try and look to the future and have the power demand met before it before we outrun it. And it's a big deal. There's been a lot, I should say, regionally and in the western United States diminishment of coal power plants without, well, they've been suggested that they're being replaced by solar and wind, but most of those have been unable to keep the same standard. They produce power in ideal situations, but they don't produce the consistency when weather systems are not ideal to keep the keep us from having brownouts.
Yeah. How do you feel about nuclear power? I mean, the cooling, which of course takes a lot of water to make happen, which is why, of course, we see many nuclear power plants along the coast or along waterways. And, you know, we certainly have the Great Salt Lake, but that seems to be already compromised. So is this realistic for Utah?
I believe it is, because almost every system that we use to generate power is going to require water. Now, hydroelectric obviously is optimal, but there's also an aversion to creating new dams. So it seems that we're kind of beating ourselves up in all through the West on that front as well. But I do support nuclear. In the past, they've been very difficult to permit. It takes years and years, and oftentimes they run into troubles. As recent as 10 years ago, there was one proposed for the Green River and River area in Utah that never came through because of permitting issues. Right now, we're working in the state, and several of our local cities are working with modular nuclear plants. One's underway, and at least the research on it, and the finished product is going to come soon in Idaho. And if we can get these small modular, and certainly they're small enough that they can be moved around on trucks and other things, to actually locate them where they work best, whether it's the water they need for cooling or whatever, we'll start to make nuclear a lot more both affordable. They're certainly a lot more safe than they've been in the past. This won't be as so large that it'll encumber the whole area or make it a hazard to have in an area. But I think nuclear has got to play a role in the future simply because it's clean. In some people's mind it isn't, but it's clean, and it certainly on an emissions standpoint is less than anything else we've got except hydro.
Yeah, but Japan has taught us, I mean, with the majority of Utahns living along a major fault line, really, does that make sense?
Well, the ones that, what I've read about these small plants is they're modular enough and set up in such a way that they're not going to be like the plants we've seen in the past. Three Mile Island was one I remember as a kid that had trouble because of some other problems, and certainly the tsunami in Japan caused trouble. These would be small enough that they wouldn't, supposedly aren't affected by seismic problems. Certainly they can be shut down and mothballed really quick in a situation like that. The one in Japan, I mean, it obviously had its problems with the earthquake, but it was the tsunami and the power loss that was the problem based on where it was located along the coast. So indications are that I've read that if they wouldn't have the tidal wave that further took out some of its support, they would have been able to save it. I mean, it shut down as it normally would in an emergency, but they lost control of it when there was no more power there. So there's some things that we can do, but again, you talk to people around, or some of the concerned citizens in the area, or in the West, they don't want dams because it affects rivers, so that takes your hydro away, and that's been happening all the way around the West. And solar and wind, we've proven, doesn't work. We need some technological difference or improvements in those, as well as batteries. Eventually, I believe that's what the future is. But in the meantime, we know that we have the ability to do nuclear, and in my opinion, it can be done safely in spite of the
in spite of the possibility of earthquakes.
Okay, I want to give you an opportunity here to tell us, your constituents, about some of the bills, or important bills, that you'll be bringing to this year's session.
Well, and I'm not a heavy bill runner. I try to work with bills, especially those that affect local government, and try to improve some of them. But as far as some I'm going to run this year, one's an election bill, which there'll be a lot of based on the election processes that we just went through. Mine has to do with signature gathering, either for those running for election under SB 54 or for a referendum similar to what is going on now in Summit County with this referendum on Dakota. But in the election process, there was some concern about what the names, being able to audit the names and make sure they were valid. I have a bill that would make all names on a referendum public information within 5 days after certification of those names, not the signatures. Those are more protected, but just the names on those ballots are on the signature process. I think that would help with transparency and everybody being able to see really what's going on, so we don't have concerns or even the suspicion of concern about it. We got a couple, got one on mechanics liens. We have a lot of building in the area, and a lot of times, and it's not widespread, but enough that when you have a building of a building and some of the subs don't get paid, but the owner has already paid the general, oftentimes that goes back as a double hit on the owner, trying to change the rules so that the general or whoever ordered that service by a sub or somebody else lower on the totem pole, it falls back on them to pay that if they've already been paid. So that's just a technical change, but I think it'll help us out a little bit. Hmm. I've got one on HOAs and management of HOAs, which affects Wasatch and Summit County a lot. I'm probably going to combine that with Representative Walter, who's out of the St. George area, who has more issues. His concern is wider than the one I had, but I'm going to combine my bill with his, which will just give citizens involved in HOAs a little bit more control over the fees they get and emergency use of their reserves and other things like that, which should help in cost.
Okay.
Got a few agriculture bills otherwise, which I'm involved in, but those are the main ones, not for the general public. I think those are the best ones of interest.
Real quick, did you get a good turnout at last night's Summit County GOP legislative update at the Ecker Hill Middle School?
Yeah, I'd love to have more, but we probably had 50 people there and lots of good questions, and I'd love to see people interested. We are going to try with Sierra, the new representative that's replacing Kara Berkland. We're going to try and do a couple of them during the session in the evenings when we can get away and continue that. So, yeah, it was great. I love to have the interaction with the citizen, and I hope they'll continue to contact us, and we'll work out to work our side to try and do that more often.
Okay. Mike, I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate the time for you. Thank you.
That's State Representative Mike Kohler. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City Council meets Thursday in its regular session starting at 5:30. In the studio with a meeting preview, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. Hey, real quick, so during the regular meeting, Council set to appoint Park City Museum Director Dalton Gackle to fill a vacancy on the Historic Preservation Board. So did somebody resign?
We did. This is one of those unique boards where we actually, the composition isn't necessarily all Park City residents. There is a component within this board where we do seek some architectural experience as well as some historic preservation experience. And Dalton Gackle, he's not actually the director of the museum. He's an employee of the museum. Fortunately, he is a resident. And he really fills that bucket of having experience in research and the archives division when it comes to historic preservation. But unfortunately, Jack Hodgkins, who was formerly a Salt Lake City resident and a longtime preservation board member, is moving to Colorado, so he stepped down.
Okay, yeah, Dalton, I missed. It's Morgan Pierce, who's the director.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. Council will also be introduced to the members of the Park City Youth Advisory Council. Who is this, and what do they do?
Yeah, this is a pretty neat undertaking here. It's a collaboration between the school district and the municipality, where we have engaged local students, grades 7 through 12, in local government and civics. And so working closely with the school district, we had a recruitment here. We had almost 40 applications received, selecting 13 members, three are alternates, and really they're going to be learning all about municipal and county government, working with the school district and the city. So they'll be attending Local Officials Day at the Utah League of Cities and Towns. They'll be participating in our leadership programs where we have Local Government Day, or we have Leadership 101 Day, when you learn about all the nonprofits and intergovernmental entities and their initiatives in town. And they'll learn a little bit about parliamentary procedure. They're going to sit in on some city council meetings. They'll likely learn how to testify, build a PowerPoint presentation, and really get to know our council members and other municipal officials. I should disclose that I know some of these applicants. I was not involved in the process. My son is in middle school, and so I'm aware of some of these individuals on here, but obviously I had nothing to do with the selection process.
That's great. I'm glad to see him involved. Some final approvals set for Sundance 2025. Everything ready to go here?
Yeah, I think more or less it's going to be what you saw last year in terms of the venues that are operable. But, you know, I think just looking out your window here, this is a big lift. The municipality spent the last 2 to 3 weeks peak period, high holidays, and we had several snowstorms. So we were all hands on deck, two extremely busy weeks over the holiday, running buses, plows, parking, transit systems, sort of you name it. And I say we had a little bit of a respite for a few days, but here we go again. So we're beginning all of the back of the house preparations. So if members of the community are driving through the venues or coming through Sweet Alley, they'll begin to see as we're sort of turning over the city to welcome the next Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah, and we know gridlock, of course, and that Old Town area is always an issue. We tried one way last year. We had to stop that short. What are the plans to do it this year?
Yeah, you know, it's always a challenge. Obviously, we're in a slot canyon, and if you're like me, you've probably attended large events or festivals all over the place. You know, I came from the Boston area, so the Boston Marathon or things like that. When municipalities reach a certain point, sometimes they're forced to sort of shut down infrastructure or really channel how people are accessing an area in control for safety, ingress and egress. And so there may be some additional measures taken this year. There are some unfortunate occurrences that have happened around the country in New Orleans and other areas. And so our public safety officials and emergency management officials are working hard on this year's plan and may have to make some changes as a result of those.
Yeah, we're going to hear about those soon.
I think so. I think Wade Carpenter, our chief of police, our transit, our traffic divisions, our parking divisions are working with the local business district and the festival provider to see if there's some changes that we need to make this year on Main Street. And to your point, you know, the traffic and congestion, I think when it comes to safety, it can cut two ways. I think there's a component of it where it does slow everything down and it meters what is sort of an unmeetable demand, where the demand exceeds our capacity. However, there's also a congestion component that could be scary about getting emergency vehicles in and out of areas. And then obviously what occurred in New Orleans is a scary event where you're really trying to secure streets or public places where you have volumes of individuals, in this case it would be festival goers or otherwise. And so our teams are working on that really hard behind the scenes. We obviously understand there could be negative impact to the businesses. It's never easy to sort of shut down areas, and we're always trying to balance the public safety needs vis-a-vis the business and economic and festival needs.
Okay. Has the city heard anything about the future of Sundance? They're supposed to hear what their decision is after the this year's festival, but have you been contacted? I mean, have they talked to you about any questions about the joint submission with Salt Lake City?
Well, we're actively engaged in that request for proposals process, and we are a finalist. But right now, our full focus is on the Sundance Film Festival, and but you know, concurrently, we're in that process with several other communities.
All right, a blast from the past. Passed a new request from Redis Park City. This was the group I think that at one point was going to develop Bonanza Flat before the city bought it. Yeah.
I don't think that's the case. I don't think this is the group. You know, Redis is a successor of United Park City Mines, and they're a successor through a foreclosure proceeding. And so they have come in with a proposal to the mayor and council really to potentially amend the Flagstaff Development Agreement, and sort of does a few things. In exchange for, I believe it's 7 units overall, granting real property to the municipality. I think it's around 300 acres. Some of it is under a conservation easement and some of it is not. giving the municipality several trailheads, like the Daly Trailhead, Empire Pass, the Mid-Mountain Trailhead, as well as some mining structures, some actual structures that we put some money into collaboratively with the Empire Pass Owners Association and Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. So there's sort of a land exchange here in exchange for their ability to deliver 7 units. And then finally, sort of wrapping up some legacy water rights and uncertainty that has always occurred initially through United Park City Nines, but now through the successor Redis.
So I think the way that I read the map, these 7 residences would basically go above where we see the Mid-Mountain parking area before we close the gate up to Bonanza.
Well, I think there's 2 locations, to be clear. The first is when you're driving up to Empire Pass and you first sort of see the Montage for the first time, that big hotel. On the right-hand side, there's a development. I think the last development's called Nakoma. And to your left would be Argent, which is a large condominium building. Sort of off the hill to the right-hand side there, that's one pod that's already zoned for residential, so it wouldn't have to be rezoned. And then the other pod, to your point, is more up by the Empire Pass Deer Valley Lodge. That's sort of when you're taking that corner, it's usually called the water tank parcel. And that parcel is somewhat owned by the city, I'll say. It has a reverter. It really has one use, and that would be for some type of a public safety facility. And, you know, we've contacted the public safety divisions. And as you know, the fire district recently renovated their Silver Lake facility. And so there's no plans for that. And if that property isn't used for a public safety facility by 2029, it reverts back to Redis anyways. Mm-hmm. So they've identified those 2 locations in exchange for granting real property, open space to the community, trailheads, some water rights, and then the mining structures. And the reason they're coming to the mayor and council is because the property we were just discussing is actually owned by the city temporarily until 2029. But none of this has begun yet. This is sort of the first step. This is Redis coming through the front door and making this proposal. If council were interested, they would enter into a letter of intent with Redis. And then the full force and effect of our planning process, regulations, and codes would be levied upon this proposal like it would any other proposal.
Hmm. It's an area, again, on the left-hand side where there are no homes, no lights, no nothing. So it's just to think that, I mean, it's a snowshoeing area, I know, because I've used it at night where it's, you know, under the moon. It's really nice without houses detracting from that, but we'll see. You say that Redis is the successor in the land that was previously owned by United Park City Mines. So what about Talisker? I mean, they're the ones that went bankrupt. I mean, they're the group that bought United Park City Mines.
Yeah, and I think to be fair, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to pretend to be an attorney. But I think the distinction between bankruptcy and foreclosure is overstated. It's actually a very complex part of the law. And we use them sort of interchangeably, mm-hmm. these words and nomenclature, and that's inaccurate. I think they're actually very different proceedings, legal proceedings, and I don't want to, you know, try to pontificate about those because I'm not an expert in either one. But this is the result of a foreclosure proceeding where Redis has become a successor to some of the assets owned either by Talisker or UPCM before that. And so I don't want to get ahead of myself. We do have individuals, though, that have a lot of knowledge in this area if you had more questions.
Yeah, thank you for that distinction. Yes, because that property was foreclosed on. But I guess at some point, the Environmental Protection Agency was looking for that successor, because what we've got is some uncleaned up tailings along Empire Creek all the way down to Richardson Flat. And there was this big investigation going on. So if Redis is the successor, why aren't they the ones cleaning this up?
Yeah, Leslie, that's a great question. And it's a difficult question to answer because, again, we're getting into the difference between likely a bankruptcy proceeding vis-a-vis a foreclosure proceeding. So just bear with me for a minute. But, where Redis is only the successor in interest, and they have foreclosed on certain properties, mm-hmm. not all properties. And so you and I just sitting here having a cup of coffee and having a conversation, if you could choose which properties to foreclose on and which properties not to foreclose on, you would clearly prefer the ones that didn't have environmental degradation or issues. And so we are led to believe just that that's occurred. So the successor in interest has obviously been strategic in what they have foreclosed on. on and what they've chosen not to foreclose on.
All right. And finally, a sales and property tax discussion. Is this, what, just a foreshadowing of a property tax increase discussion later this year?
I don't think so. That's the first I've heard of that. Believe it or not, this is more or less a big kickoff to our annual budgeting process. It's hard to believe. It's January. We just discussed Sundance is right around the corner. We just came off two huge holiday weeks. But internally in the municipality, we're kicking off our budgeting process. And we had a request from council that before we began forecasting future revenues for the next fiscal year, we really just take perhaps a rollback or a step back and provide an overview on the entire tax and revenue structure of the municipality. And this report actually doesn't focus a lot on the property tax. It really focuses heavily on sales taxes overall. And it focuses on all of the sales taxes that are levied in Park City, both by the municipality, transit sales taxes, by the county, and otherwise. So it's a little bit of both. I haven't heard anything about a property tax increase, but believe it or not, it's that time of year again where we kick off our budgeting process.
Okay, Matt, I've got to leave it there. Anything else you want to mention?
That's it, Leslie. Thanks so much, and we look forward to a fun Sundance Film Festival. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. That's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Here in the studio now with an update from the Heber Valley Chamber, I have Executive Director Dallin Kosher playing musical chairs.
Yeah, I'm like, which microphone do I want to use today?
Let's start with your lodging numbers, which you track by transient room tax numbers. How are things looking this winter?
You know, the winter is looking about average, right, as we normally see. It's funny. We noticed that when snow years are kind of low like this, we get a lot of visitors into our visitor center. People are saying, what should we do? There's no snow. We've had a little bit of an uptick, but not as much as we would expect. So I think there's people still out there on the slopes, getting out there as much as they can. So that's exciting to hear that. We know that the Grand Hyatt has opened up in November, so that was really exciting. We saw our occupancy by a percentage dip, but that's to be expected because of we have a whole new product online, right? So that the numbers just play out that way, right? We have they have, what is it, like 400 rooms at the Grand Hyatt. So that changed our occupancy, but we'll tick back up. We'll get there. So we had a meeting with our board just recently and said, don't panic. It's going to happen. We're going to see occupancy dip a little bit. But that's just because it's a numbers game, and we'll get back up. So that's exciting. But overall for the year, we're seeing relatively flat transient room tax. You know, 6 to 8% is good. Not the double digits we've seen in years past, but it's still growing, and it will continue to grow. But this year didn't grow at the pace that we've seen in previous years. But Still up a little bit.
Well, hey, I mean, most people would say an 8% return is actually pretty good.
Yeah, right. I'll take an 8% return. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so I would say more than flat. I mean, 6 to 8 is certainly growth. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see how it ends. Like, we have numbers through October, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's always delayed a little bit. So we'll see how it pans out. But that's our current estimate. So,
all right, restaurant tax. It looks to also finish the year higher than expected.
Yeah, that was a great surprise for us to see that restaurant tax was up through October about 15%. We normally hover around the $1 million mark with restaurant tax, and we were already at 1.3 in October. So that doesn't include the holiday season and stuff. So we're pretty confident and excited about the opportunity that will bring for our restaurants and businesses. So we hope to continue to bring visitors to the town and residents out to enjoy our restaurants.
So is this, though, because just restaurant prices are higher, or is it really that more people are eating out?
You know, that is a wonderful question, because I have talked to some of the restauranteurs, and they would say the numbers are, you know, the cost per table is up, but the number of tables is down, if that makes sense. Yeah, so you're on par with that assessment, and we'll have to see if that holds true for all restaurants. But that is something that we have heard from a few different restaurateurs.
Okay, some new business though in town.
Yeah, so you know, this in 2024 we had 19 ribbon cuttings. It's kind of nice to see some of these new businesses come to town, and so it's I wish I could remember all of them off the top of my head, but they are some great businesses. We are always excited to see new ones come in. And that's we average about one a month, so it was cool to see that hit 19 for 2024. And that's been pretty cool for us. Our membership is continuing to grow. We're currently sitting at about 324 members with 78 new members in 2024. You know, we have, overall we've grown. We have some members that either drop off or move out of town or close shop. So that fluctuates a little bit, but we are seeing continued sustained growth with our chamber membership. So that's exciting for us and causes growing pains. And hey, we need more staff. So it's been a good growth experience for us to keep working with our businesses and helping them.
Yeah. All right. What about the jobs market? It sounds like you did see a slight job.
We did see a slight decrease in the job market. I was through the Department of Workforce Services and the numbers that they track. We saw a small decrease in hospitality jobs. And I think that was reflective in our community. Which is interesting because we don't see things like occupancy rates being down that much or changing that much. So it's interesting that I think it's probably in the restaurant businesses and some of those places. But I do think the irony will be that as Deer Valley East Village continues to open up and expand, that will reverse the trend pretty quickly.
down almost 3%. And I guess I would be surprised by that, just given that we have a new 400-room hotel online.
And this might have been, you know, they always do their numbers in an interesting time frame. But that was the latest that we had seen. And for the community as a whole, we do see construction up with, you know, the East Village and other things still happening in Wasatch County. But overall, the unemployment rate is under 4%, and so it's still really, really good. I'm saying I think it's 3.5. So I think the hot market of everybody's hiring is slowed a little bit, but our unemployment rate is still pretty solid. As far as we'll have everybody have a job who wants a job, but we know that those are about right where we should be.
Okay, let's talk about goals for this year then. What are you looking at?
In 2025, we were really looking forward to aligning and refocusing our efforts at the chamber, kind of focusing on what can we do, what can we be the best at, what can we really hone in our details on. We have a 10-year plan, destination development plan, that we will reevaluate and say, we started this in 2020, so around COVID time, and so it's been 4 years. So let's decide what's changed, what's new, what we need to expect. The plan was kind of looking for a 2030 Olympics, but now we have 2034. So we will readjust and look at those things to make sure that we're on track. Or hey, what these things seem out of date. In addition to that, we're continuing to focus our efforts on destination development. And when I say that, I'm not talking about, hey, there's open land here, let's put something here. It's what would make the experience enhanced for our visitor and our resident. So that I think that's, I talk about this with my staff. It's like, what do we build and what do we not build, right? That's really a key sentiment that we need to make sure that there's open space, that there's community and all these different things. And so there's that two-edged sort of that. What do we want to see happen and what do we not want to see happen from a growth standpoint, and how can we influence that? And one of the things we are working on is enhancing the town squares, both Midway and Heber City. I don't know if you've been out in Midway recently. They have been rocking it with some really great retails and restaurant spaces around their town square, making it more walkable and more enjoyable, really. And so it's been a neat thing to see Midway City being doing that a little more organically. But with Heber City, we're going to have to kind of put a little more effort into it because of the establishments of old buildings and new structures that we need to put together. So a lot of work to be done there, but things are happening to create that vibe in our community.
Okay, and just the last 30 seconds, I know that you're also looking to even expand better the July 4th celebration, which you hadn't done until this year.
Right, so this will be our third year for the July 4th Red, White, and Blue Festival, but we're adding a new concert at the event center. You know, Provo has the Stadium of Fire. We're going to, I jokingly call it the Stadium on Fire. So what we're going to do, no, just kidding. But we're going to have a concert. We'll have announced the band here in March. But all these things are trying to create this vibe that where people want to be in our small town for 4th of July.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Dallin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Dallin Kosher is the executive director of the Heber Valley Chamber. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.